This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of July 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Austin preparing to open a field hospital in the convention center.
Right now, the hospitals are stretched with patients and looking for help.
Austin's police chief, Brian Manley, praised as a hero after the Austin bombings. Now there's a push to get rid of him.
I was an early supporter of Chief Manley, and I have been incredibly disappointed.
And Austin's airport expansion was cleared for takeoff, but the pandemic has caused some turbulence.
Right now, we're averaging around 5,000 outbound passengers each day. On a typical day this time of year, we would usually see around 30,000 outbound passengers.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
We have a little glimmer of hope in this week's numbers, where we've seen a slight leveling off of the hospitalization numbers. Where we were on a rapid increase, we've seen that plateau slightly just over the last few days.
Dr. Jason Pickett is the city's alternate health authority. He spoke this week.
It is difficult to say if that is going to remain or if we are going to continue on this upward trend. The hospitals right now are stretched, and they are pulling staff in from hospitals in other areas and contract staffing to increase their capabilities. But right now, the hospitals are stretched with patients and looking for help from the state and from their other hospitals as well. We too are requesting those resources from the state on behalf of the hospitals, and we are also standing up our alternate care site, our field hospital, if you will, to help take some of that burden from the hospitals to help them to care for more patients, especially those who are critically ill.
That alternate COVID-19 care site is being readied at the Austin Convention Center.
Our planned go-live date for that hospital is July the 21st, so next Tuesday, I think. And when they start taking patients, that's largely up to the hospitals when they feel they can start. They need to start offloading patients. The emphasis with the alternate care site is that we're taking care of patients with lower acuity disease, what would be referred to as med-surg level acuity. So that's a like your garden variety hospital bed level acuity. We're not planning to run an ICU in the convention center. We don't think that that's practical, and folks who are critically ill that need that level of care are best served in the hospitals where the quality of that care will be the best.
So where are we at now? Here's an update on hospital capacity for the big three hospital operators in Austin: Ascension Seton, Baylor Scott & White Health, and St. David's Healthcare. Currently, among all three healthcare systems, they have almost 2,500 staffed beds. Of those, 74% are occupied. Among the three healthcare systems, there are almost 500 ICU beds. Those are 89% occupied. Now, Travis County is in the process of buying three refrigerated trucks to serve as mobile morgues in case they are needed from a surge in COVID-19 related deaths. County spokesperson Hector Nieto says they don't need them now, but they're doing it just to be prepared.
We want to make certain that if this surge continues, we are prepared to adequately take care of any increased case numbers and deaths.
Two of the refrigerated trucks would be used as backups to private morgues, and the third would serve the medical examiner's office. These concerns motivated Austin public health officials to issue an order this week related to schools. Here's Dr. Jason Pickett again.
And we have ordered that we not have in-person classes until at least September the 8th, and that includes athletics. And this is to protect our children and also to protect our teachers. As we've seen from other areas that have opened schools early while there's still transmission, active transmission within their communities, when you look at South Korea, when you look at Israel, then opening too early led to substantial increase in cases, and they had to dial things back again. We don't want to make that same mistake here in Austin. We want to learn from the experiences of others so that when we do open up, that we do not end up with another surge of cases, so we do not have to close back down again.
Public schools across Texas will be able to provide online instruction for the first 8 weeks of school under new guidance issued today by the Texas Education Agency. The second 4 weeks of that 8 week stretch would be an extension authorized by the school board. They need to get a waiver from the TEA. Now, Mike Morath is the commissioner of the TEA. Thanks for speaking to KUT.
Thanks for having me.
This new guidance is a change from the first round of guidance issued by the TEA. This new round of guidance seems to give school districts more leeway. Is it possible, Commissioner, that these guidelines could change again, depending on the impact of the coronavirus in Texas?
Yeah, starting in March, we had to make adjustments weekly, given the constantly changing public health circumstances caused by coronavirus. So we've tried to be flexible throughout. We will continue to make adjustments as necessary, as dictated by the public health conditions on the ground. The guidance that we've provided today is about flexibility, because the coronavirus doesn't have the same level of community spread in every community in Texas. What is happening in Travis County in terms of the level of COVID cases is very different than, say, the level of COVID cases in rural Pecos County. And so the flexibility that we've provided today builds on the framework that we published previously, so that school districts, if they want to, if the local public health conditions warrant it, if it is what is necessary to keep staff and students safe, can be virtual for some period of time during the start of the school year. But if conditions allow it, they don't have to do that. And in addition, during this time period, we know that not every family has access to the internet or devices at home. And so, one, we're trying to solve that problem. We're providing $200 million worth of hotspots and e-learning devices to families all over the state of Texas. But two, we also have ensured that during this transition period, those families that don't have access to the internet, if they wish for their child to be on campus, they are able to have their children on campus during that transition window.
So presumably that means those districts will have to have staff on campus to serve those children. What do you say to the concerns of employees about returning to work during a pandemic?
Yeah, so if you think about a campus that has, say, 800, it's an elementary school campus built for 800 kids, having 80 children in that environment is a really kind of controlled setting. And so we would encourage local school systems to offer on-campus instruction as soon as it is safe, as soon as they have the procedures down that allow it to proceed for their students. But it will vary from local context to local context.
The president of the Texas State Teachers Association, Ovidia Molina, does not agree, and she wants schools to be kept closed. Let's hear from her.
We don't know exactly when it is going to be safe. We don't want to come back when it isn't safe. So an arbitrary timeline is not what we want. We want TA and the governor, actually, to have a statewide order that says that school buildings will remain closed until it is safe to begin to come back to school without a date, and that school funding should not be withheld from any school district to do so. We want our schools fully funded, and we want them to be able to prepare for our schools to open safely.
Do you agree?
Not given the geographic diversity of Texas, and also not given what we know about the impact of the virus on children, which is, again, a very different situation than its impact on adults. We have, you know, 5.5 million souls in Texas public schools as school children, but we also have 700,000 adults. We have to keep our staff and our students safe. But the on-campus instructional environment is very valuable for kids. We have students who are homeless, students who don't have ready access to meals at home. And ensuring that they have access to this is, in fact, important. And also, again, what is necessary as in a place like Travis County or Bexar County or Harris County is going to be different given the level of community spread that you see there than in some of our far more rural communities. You know, people forget about Texas's geographic diversity, but we have somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million kids being educated in rural schools in Texas. We're the largest educator of rural school children in the nation. And so a one-size-fits-all order doesn't make sense for a state of our size and diversity.
Now, you mentioned that the virus treats children differently. I think there's a lower death rate among children, but the concern expressed by epidemiologists here in Austin has been that children could then take the virus and spread it around to their homes and around the community and make the situation even worse. Is that something that might require more than 8 weeks once we're in August and we have a better picture of where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, as we've learned more about this virus throughout the crisis, we've made adjustments. As we've seen facts on the ground change, we've made adjustments. We will continue to be guided by the best and most up-to-date science and the conditions on the ground to ensure that we keep our staff, our teachers, our students safe.
What do you say to the parents who are struggling to return to work and they're trying to take care of their children all day and they want them back in the classrooms now? There's a lot of people who wish that schools would offer in-person instruction from the very start. What do you say to those parents?
Well, I am one of them. I have four young children at home. My twins are two, but my two older children are school age in Austin ISD, and we would certainly like to have them back in an on-campus environment as soon as possible. But there is a pandemic. It's been a big disruption in our lives for many months, and it's going to continue to be. We are going to try to ensure that on-campus instruction is available to every family that needs it as quickly as possible. But we also know that the steps that the state has taken in the past to flatten the curve have worked. The steps that the state is taking now to flatten the curve are likely to work as well, and we may need to give that some time.
Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The University of Texas announced this week some changes to address racial inequality on campus and in its athletics program. As KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, the university is once again trying to figure out how to reconcile its racist past while preparing for a more diverse future.
First, the eye-catching stuff. What was called the Joe Jamail Field at DKR Texas Memorial Stadium will now be named the Earl Campbell and Ricky Williams Field. The school will also honor its first black football letterman, Julius Whittier, with a statue nearby. The Longhorns will still be listening to the Eyes of Texas before and after every game, but the school says it will teach its origins and work to reimagine its future. Some big changes on campus as well. There will be more robust efforts to recruit black students, faculty, and staff, an effort Clotilde Davis-Haynes has been asking for decades. She is president of the Precursors, an alumni group of African Americans who enrolled in the early years of UT Austin's desegregation.
I see, for the first time in a long time, significant movement toward addressing these very complicated and complex issues.
The Precursors, along with Heman Sweat, will have their stories memorialized on campus as well. One building, Robert L. Moore Hall, is getting renamed. It will now just be called the Physics, Math, and Astronomy Building. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
A study commissioned by criminal justice advocates finds the majority of calls Austin police respond to are not crime-related. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, the study comes as the city of Austin considers rethinking its approach to funding police in its next budget.
The third-party study commissioned by the Austin Justice Coalition found 65% of the time Austin police officers are dispatched to 911 calls that don't involve crime. While about a fifth of calls were crime-related, only a sixth of a percent were related to violent crime. AH Datalytics, the New Orleans-based firm contracted by AJC, analyzed more than 1 million calls over 18 months. The study comes on the heels of City Manager Spencer Kronk's proposed budget for 2021. In the wake of a national uprising against police violence and racism, criminal justice advocates have called on Kronk's office to make drastic cuts to APD's $434 million budget. Kronk's first draft, unveiled Monday, calls for an $8 million cut. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Black chiefs of staff for state lawmakers are calling for the removal of Confederate monuments on the Capitol grounds and new laws to change policing in Texas. KUT's Sangeeta Menon reports.
In a letter to the Texas House Democratic Caucus, 10 black chiefs of staff called for policy changes, including banning no-knock warrants and strangleholds, reallocating funds from the Department of Public Safety to support services, and restricting police officer indemnification. The chiefs of staff wrote they were exasperated with the system that they say was intentionally designed to work against people who look like them. Otis Avagaro was one of the co-signers.
There's a lot of things that's unique about being in the role that I am in, and I intend to take full advantage of that to seek justice and equality for people who look like me, for the disenfranchised, for the marginalized, and for the voiceless.
Avagaro says they will continue to hold a spotlight to their proposed reforms and keep the pressure on legislators to make changes. Sangeeta Menon, KUT News.
The calls for Austin Police Chief Brian Manley to be fired are getting louder. Technically, Manley cannot be fired. He can be demoted, and of course, he can resign. 2 years ago, city council members were singing his praises. They appointed him Austin's permanent police chief with a unanimous vote. Now, the same council members have voted that they have no confidence in him. How did that happen? KUT's Audrey McGlinchey tried to answer that question. To do so, she started in March 2018.
On the second day of that month, Anthony Stefan House, a 39-year-old father, picked up a package left on his front porch. It exploded, killing him.
FBI, ATF, even postal inspectors were among the investigators on Haverford Drive on Friday. Austin police didn't have much information to provide.
Days later, APD Assistant Chief Joseph Chacon said police were not yet calling House's death a homicide. House was black.
We can't rule out that Mr. House didn't construct this himself and then accidentally detonated, in which case it would be an accidental death.
This was the start of weeks of terror in Austin. Two people were murdered, several others injured, before police cornered the bomber in a hotel parking lot where he killed himself. But it was also the start of two narratives in the city, one where police had blamed a black man for his own murder, another where police had fearlessly brought down a domestic terrorist. These stories weren't independent of one another, but they all happened under then-interim police chief Brian Manley.
So you had a white community looking at him like he was a hero.
Alberta Phillips is a freelance journalist and a former editorial writer for the Austin American Statesman.
And you had many people in the black community who were looking at him very skeptically. Is he up to this job?
3 months after the Austin bombings, Manley stood in front of the city's 11-member council. Then Mayor Pro Tem Kathy Tovo addressed him.
You are a servant leader, and you have my complete confidence, I have complete confidence in you, and I'll be delighted to cast my vote here in just a minute for your confirmation.
1 month after the Austin bomber killed himself, City Manager Spencer Kronk announced that instead of doing a national search for a permanent police chief, Manley, who had been with APD for 3 decades, would be the sole finalist for the job. 2 months later, council members voted unanimously to give it to him.
It's unanimous on the dais. Congratulations, Chief.
Thank you very much.
It sounded like everyone, at least everyone in City Hall, was enthusiastic about the decision. But others were wary. Phillips, formerly of the Statesman, said there was a thought lingering in her mind that day.
I think that Chief Manley was seen as a very nice man, a decent man, a family man. But I doubt anybody saw Chief Manley as a visionary or a change agent.
Fast forward a year and a half. Last November, complaints surfaced against one of Manley's secondhand men. Someone was accusing Assistant Chief Justin Newsom of using a racist term for black people on numerous occasions.
Disturbing. Repugnant.
Councilmember Natasha Harper Madison called for an investigation. It would later reveal a culture of racism, sexism, and a fear of retaliation within the department.
Who knew what and when did they know it? Whose lives and careers were affected? And how entrenched any culture of racism is in our police department?
This is the moment when council members began voicing their doubts about Manley. Here's Mayor Pro Tem Delia Garza.
Repeated incidences by our department have really shaken my faith in many ways.
Then she addressed the police chief.
I was an early supporter of Chief Manley, and I have been incredibly disappointed.
Council members were further disappointed in January. That's when they took a big vote on marijuana.
This week, the Austin City Council has a really important opportunity to lead on criminal justice reform, on marijuana policy reform, on taking action that can lead.
Prosecutors around the state, including in Travis County, had stopped trying low-level marijuana cases after a new state law went into effect. People would show up to court and be turned away. So council members said, let's not waste our resources and stop ticketing and arresting people for something they won't be prosecuted for. Here's council member Greg Kassar before the vote.
It just makes sense in this environment for us to lead the way and for us to dedicate our limited resources on investing in our community rather than investing in pursuing low-level marijuana offenses.
At a press conference the next day, Manley said police would do nothing differently.
It was not decriminalized. It is still illegal, and the Austin Police Department will still enforce marijuana law.
But 2 weeks ago, Manley reversed his decision, saying police would now no longer ticket or arrest people for small amounts of marijuana. But at that point, people were already calling for him to resign. That started in late April.
During this pandemic, we are gathered here to discuss the senseless shooting of Mike Ramos that happened Friday evening.
That's Chaz Moore with the Austin Justice Coalition on a video call talking about the APD shooting of Ramos, a Black and Hispanic man. Ramos had been hanging out in the parking lot of an apartment complex in Southeast Austin. Officer Christopher Taylor shot him as he backed out of a parking spot and drove away from police. Moore said he and other local organizations had signed a letter to the city manager, mayor, and council, asking that Manley resign or be demoted.
Many of us on this call, many of you watching, have tried to be at the table with the Austin Police Department to make sure we can push our police department in the best, most safe direction as possible. And it is with much sadness to report that we have not been able to do so.
A month later, council members would co-sign this sentiment. During the last weekend of May, people protested in downtown Austin against systemic racism and recent police killings. Over the next 2 days, police shot lead pellet-filled bags at protesters, seriously injuring at least 10 people. Days later, council members Kassar and Garza asked Manley to resign.
So, Chief, for our city to heal and for our community to make progress, I believe the honorable thing would be for you to resign the position of police chief.
A week later, every council member signed a resolution saying they had no confidence in Manley's ability to change the department for the better. I asked the police chief why he thought this was, how in 2 years' time, council members had gone from unanimously supporting him to saying they didn't think he could make the changes necessary to make policing safe for everyone.
I can't speak to their motivation or what led them, those that spoke on that issue. Some of them spoke about it, and then, of course, they all voted. But I can't speculate on what led them to come to that.
I mean, you must have some reaction to them voting, saying they have no confidence in your leadership.
Well, they voted that they had no confidence that we would carry out the direction that they gave. And again, that's disappointing because I've got, as I just went through, so many of the progressive steps we've taken as a department, some on our own accord and some at the direction of council. So I think that we do have a history of following their direction and of trying to implement policies based on resolutions that they pass.
Under Manley's leadership, the number of times police arrested someone when instead they could have given them a ticket dropped 79%. He agreed to do away with a juvenile curfew that was putting many young people of color into the court system. He agreed to a third-party audit of how police handle sexual assault cases after it was revealed that the department had misclassified rape cases in 2017. But community activists and some council members say when they ask for change, it's often met with resistance. And now, when people across the country are demanding big, big changes to police, they think someone new is the one to do that. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
It has been a hot July in Central Texas so far, and above-average temperatures are expected to stay. As KUT's Mose Bushell reports, forecasters at the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration warned this week of drought and heat into the fall.
In a monthly climate briefing, NOAA said there was a chance a La Nina weather pattern would return this fall. That, along with other factors, means they are predicting hotter and drier weather for the next few months. NOAA climatologist Ira Sanchez Lugo said this year has already been hotter than usual across the globe.
The year 2020 is almost certain to rank among the five warmest years on record, with a 35.8% chance of it being the warmest year on record.
Experts warn heat and drought will only get worse in Texas as climate change persists. Last month, the state climatologist of Texas said that policymakers should prepare for so-called mega droughts lasting decades to grip the state by the end of the century. Mose Bushell, KUT News.
Public health officials in Travis County have identified mosquitoes carrying West Nile virus in the area. KUT's Jerry Quijano has more.
The first positive pool of mosquitoes carrying the disease was found in the 78756 zip code in Northwest Austin. More than 100 pools tested positive across the state last year, though none were in Travis County. Austin Public Health says there have been no human infections in the area yet, and they're asking people to get rid of any standing water in their yards and neighborhoods, and say mosquitoes carrying West Nile are most active between dusk and dawn.
A sample of mosquitoes collected in Williamson County also tested positive for carrying the disease last week. A team of mental health professionals in Williamson County says they are seeing an increase in cases of depression and anxiety and other mental health conditions made worse by the pandemic. KUT's Allison Ortegon reports on the Williamson County Mobile Outreach Team.
The call volume to the Mobile Outreach Team has doubled compared to this same time last year. The team is made of paramedics and licensed mental health specialists. Director Annie Burwell says they help refill medications, provide masks, make referrals to a counselor or psychiatrist, or whatever's necessary to ensure the caller's safety.
We would encourage people to reach out before a crisis occurs. So when people are starting to feel overwhelmed or hopeless or unable to cope, there's lots of people willing to help and lots of services out there.
The state of Texas also has a COVID-19 mental health support line. It's open 7 days a week at 833-986-1919. That's 833-986-1919. Allison Ortegon, KUT News.
One of the sectors hit hardest by the COVID-19 pandemic is the airline industry. Even as activity perks up just a little bit, the number of passengers and flights at Austin Bergstrom International Airport is a fraction of what it was this time last year. KUT's Samuel King has more on the turbulence caused by the pandemic.
If you haven't been to the airport in a while, you'll find that some sites are familiar. Passengers rushing to beat final check-in or boarding calls. But other sites are different. Masks are everywhere, and there's a lot more hand sanitizer and cleaning crews. It's something passenger Michael Lynn from Richmond, Virginia has noticed.
They've actually been pretty good about how they handle the separation of the seats, the cleanliness. I feel comfortable.
The same for Teresa Prince, who is heading back to Michigan after visiting her son.
About traveling, but it's what it is.
But a lot of people are still reluctant to fly. Mandy McClendon is communications and marketing manager for Austin Bergstrom International Airport.
So right now we're averaging around about 5,000 outbound passengers each day. On a typical day this time of year, we would usually see around 30,000 outbound passengers.
The traffic decline is impacting the airport financially. It's already had to cut $20 million from its budget this fiscal year. And city manager Spencer Kronk projects revenue for the airport will drop 30% in the upcoming fiscal year. McClendon says fewer travelers at the airport has a ripple effect.
And so, of course, our revenue sources are aeronautical and non-aeronautical. And both of those depend on how many passengers are traveling through our terminal. So that's not only flights, it's also, parking and concessions.
So the slowdown is also impacting people who work at the airport. Unite Here is the union that represents more than 300,000 concessions and hospitality workers across the country. It says almost 96% of its membership at Austin Bergstrom was laid off at one point. Union member Guadalupe Garcia works as a cashier at the airport.
We were already thinking that we're all going to get laid off.
Seniority meant she got to hold on to her job, but as more employees have come back to work, her hours have been cut.
When we started, we were still getting our 40 hours in the beginning. Now it went down to 30. Now I'm down to 28. I'm getting 28 hours a week right now.
Garcia says she doesn't mind, as it keeps her colleagues employed as well. The city council directed the airport to work with concession companies to find ways to preserve jobs. The $58 million in CARES Act funding the airport received can only be used for operating expenses and paying down debt, but the airport has found other solutions. Concessions fees for those companies have been suspended at least through September, providing millions of dollars in relief. The airport is waiving administrative costs for security badges once furloughed employees are rehired. The airport is also exploring how to expand technology that could allow customers to pay for food or retail items through an app and have that delivered to a passenger wherever they are in the airport. Airport leaders say that could help preserve jobs, but Unite Here's Bo Delp says the union wants to make sure workers aren't left behind.
As we explore potential uses of technology, we have to ensure that this technology does not lead to further displacement of airport workers. We have to ensure, and the city must ensure, that as it moves forward with keeping passengers and workers safe, that it is doing so in a way that actually leads to additional jobs.
Uncertainty remains about the aviation industry in the coming months. Some airlines have warned of massive layoffs when CARES Act funding provisions end later this year. But analyst Mike Boyd is optimistic that domestic travel could mostly rebound in Austin by the end of the year. In the meantime, he says airports are still at the mercy of decisions by airlines.
It's very difficult for an airport to plan when the schedule that's published by an airline today might not be there 2 weeks from now, or what they show today is half of what they're going to have 2 weeks from now. It's a balancing game.
Flights to Mexico have resumed at Austin Bergstrom, but flights to Europe are suspended indefinitely. Those flights had been part of the airport's ambitious expansion plans that included a project to double the size of the airport by adding another terminal, which is now on hold. McClendon says even though it may take a few years for traffic to return to where it was in 2019, the 2040 master plan remains in place.
We are confident that Central Texans passengers will want to travel again, and we'll be there and ready to serve them when that happens. And so even if we don't rebound quickly, we know that we will. And at that time, when that happens, we will be ready to move forward with those plans.
So airport leaders are hoping for clear skies after an unknown period of turbulence. Samuel King, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the third weekend of July 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.